Hi, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here at 102.7 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada. Today's Friday, July 20th, 2012. I'm your host, Alon Cohen, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Alyssa.
Hey, oh, that's me. I'm not sure if your mic is working, actually. Okay, you got it. Good. Yes, hi.
Awesome. And we also have Jay, who's filling in for Allison on the controls today. Thanks, Jay. So Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage a movement toward a world in which all animals, both human and non-human, are treated with compassion and care. We strive to expose all the complicated relationships we share with all the critters of this planet and wish that all animals be able to flourish to their full potential. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. On today's show, we'll be talking with Sarah Brown, who's the author of the popular blog Queer Vegan Food. Sarah works at the intersection of queer sexuality and veganism, and we'll be talking to her today about what it means to be a queer vegan and how veganism and queerness relate. She's published numerous articles on the subject and is also currently working on a book with Courtney Poole on holistic health for women who love women. We're very excited to hear what she has to say. We also have Krista Truman on the show with us, who's a member of Fat Panic Vancouver. Fat Panic Vancouver is an alliance of people of all sizes who are committing to ending the oppression of fat people and to working towards a society in which no one is taught to hate their own or anybody else's body for any reason. Krista is a vegan and also a fat-positive activist. We'll be chatting with her today about fat-shaming and body policing within the vegan community and how to respect and love our differently sized bodies and supporting people of all sizes as we make our own choices relating to health, while avoiding the notion that there is a moral obligation to strive for any particular conception of health. So you're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO. So have anything exciting happened to you this week, Alyssa?
Not really, actually. For some reason, I'm not prepared for that question. I tried some of those new Daya wedges. They were really good. But other than that,
that's good. Well, I mean,
how about you?
Vegan related and animal rights related in the day.
Not really. How about you?
No, neither have I. I'm quite excited actually for the Maximum Tolerated Dose movie that's going to be coming to Vancouver in a couple weeks, and that's pretty good. And I think we'll be chatting to Allison soon.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to ask Allison about her upcoming trip. She's not with us today, and yeah, you mentioned maximum tolerated dose, and I haven't yet scored an interview with the filmmaker for next week's show, but I am working on it, and so that's what I hope we can look forward to next week.
Great. Well, we should be actually waiting for Allison to be calling us in, but I'm not sure if she's actually going to be calling us in or not. Is she on the lines right now? No? Okay. Well, in the meantime, we can actually have essentially kind of the preface to what we're going to be talking about today. So on our show today, we'll be talking with Krista, who's, I'm actually very excited about this interview. Essentially, what's been going on within, there's kind of two communities, which Krista's been a part of, which is quite rare. At the one hand, there's the fat positive community, which is a community of people who really advocate this movement called Health at Every Size. Essentially, what Health at Every Size entails is the idea that we shouldn't be focusing on weight for our ideas of what a body should look like, but rather our main focus should be rather health. And health can actually be encapsulated in different sized bodies. So you don't have to be large or skinny to necessarily be healthy, or rather you don't have to be skinny to necessarily be healthy. And in fact, sometimes being skinny does in fact do a very real and active violence on people's bodies when there's an obsession with weight as kind of the marker of health.
Yeah, and I've also seen a couple studies at least that show that losing a lot of weight can actually be detrimental to your health. So I think it's more important to just work on your health wherever you're at, without focusing on those issues like weight loss. And I'm really excited about the show as well. And of course, Krista Truman is a former host of Animal Voices, and she has a lot to say on this topic. And I'm really excited to have that interview with her later in the show. Because I've started learning more about the Health at Every Size movement over the last year or so, and it's really really expanded my sense of happiness in the world, I think, and just really helped me accept my body where I'm at and just take down that sort of thin ideal that everyone has and just sort of erase that and just look at my own body and where I'm at. So yeah, I'm really excited about today's show.
Hi, Allison. Are you there? I'm not sure. Can you hear?
I can hear you.
Oh, there she is. Hi, Allison.
Hey.
Hey, great. I'm glad to talk to you now. Awesome. So, tell us about your trip and why you're not exactly in today.
My trip. Okay, so tomorrow I am going on a two-week vegan vacation, as I've mentioned on the show before, to New York City. We're going for 4.5 days. My friends Leslie and Denise. Denise has been on the show before. And we're going to eat our way through New York City. I've been making, tons of reservations at all the awesome vegan restaurants that there are there, like Kendall 79, Pure Food and Wine, and Blossom Restaurant. Really looking forward to that. And then we're heading to the two animal rights conferences in Washington, D.C., which we've also mentioned on the show before. The first one is the Taking Action for Animals conference, which is put on by the Humane Society of the United States. That's happening on, I think it's July 27th to 30th or 29th. And then after that, we're staying in town for a few more days because the annual National Animal Rights Conference that's put on by FARM, they are having their conference from August the 2nd to the 5th. So really, really looking forward to that. And I've been to about 3 or 4 AR conferences now, and it's a really great, awesome, event to attend. Haven't been to a TAFA conference before, but they're only once every 2 years, so taking advantage of that opportunity this year.
And so we can look forward to your review of these events on which date?
Yeah. Oh, well, let's see. I'll be back doing shows on August 24th, so mm-hmm. I'm sure I'll have something. I'm sure I'll have a report by then. And incidentally, I'm actually taking a travel and food writing course right now, which is actually on my lunch break. That's why I'm not there today. So I'm learning lots of great skills for reviewing restaurants and food, which is, as you know, what I like to do on the show. So I think I'll definitely be applying some of those skills and thinking more of it in a more applicable manner as to when I'm eating at restaurants is, what do I want to say in my review? And actually jotting down notes, which is a good idea, something I've learned in my class. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks so much.
We look forward to that. Thanks for talking to us today. And we'll see you when you get back.
In 4 weeks. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
So I just have some events to share today. First, I wanted to mention a couple film events coming up. First of all, Vancouver's newest animal rights group, the Black Paw Collective, is presenting a film screening at Rhizome Cafe next week. That's Thursday, July 26th at 7 p.m. And Rhizome is just on East Broadway, just east of Main. And the movie that they're showing is the premiere of a documentary about the Earth Liberation Front. It's called If a Tree Falls, A Story of the ELF. And they will be giving out zines, and there'll be some goodie bags. And vegan food, of course, is offered at Rhizome. Yummy, yummy vegan food. And, of course, it's a pay-what-you-can event. So that's exciting. And then the other film screening that's coming up is the following week, and that's Friday, August 3rd. There will be a screening of a film called Maximum Tolerated Dose. It's a new documentary by a Canadian filmmaker, Carl Orzechowski, and Decipher Films, and seating will be limited at the event. And of course, we need to bring friends who don't know about animal testing. And that film charts the lives of both humans and non-humans who've experienced animal testing firsthand. It has hauntingly honest testimony by scientists and lab technicians whose ethics demanded they choose a different path, and simultaneously heartwarming and heartbreaking stories of animals who've seen both sides of the cage. The film aims to reinvigorate the debate about animal testing by bringing these rarely heard perspectives to the fore. And the filmmakers will be present for a discussion after the film, and if you want to learn more, you can go to MaximumToleratedDose.org. We, of course, have VegFest coming up in a couple weeks here in Vancouver. It's a day-long outdoor festival, which will be happening for its second year on August 4th, starting at 11 a.m. This year's event will be part of the Car-Free Weekends on Granville Street and will be set up on Granville near Georgia. At the festival, there'll be vegan food vendors, tables for animal protection organizations, local businesses, and much more. And best of all, it's entirely free to attend. Volunteers and vendors are still needed. You can go to vegfestvancouver.com to contact the organizer. And I will be interviewing the organizer, Jonathan, on next week's show so we can hear more about the event and get excited about it. We have another free event coming up. I love free events. Veg Meetup Vancouver is hosting a veg picnic and free outdoor movie screening of Back to the Future. Well, actually, they're just hosting the veg picnic part, and Back to the Future will be showing at Trout Lake Park in East Vancouver, and that's Saturday, August 11th. The veg picnic will start at 6:30, and the movie starts when it gets dark enough to see the screen, of course. I don't know if you've been to outdoor movie events. I just went to my first this year, which was Spaceballs at Stanley Park, and it was really, really crowded, but really so much fun. It's really smart to bring some kind of small tarp and sleeping bags and pillows and just get really cozy, like ridiculously cozy. It's a lot of fun. So they are inviting people to bring a lawn chair and some snacks, of course. And for the exact meetup spot, you just go to meetup.com and search for Veg Meetup Vancouver. Veg Meetup Vancouver is a veg socializing group. It's a great chance for vegan and vegetarian adults to socialize with other veg mates, make friends, and have fun. Those who are interested in the veg lifestyle or trying to go veg are also welcomed as long as they're veg friendly and respectful. I think I might have time for just to mention that every Friday the Animal Defense League hosts a protest outside of Fortune Garden Seafood Restaurant at 1475 West Broadway, right near Granville. It's every Friday there. They call it Fintastic Friday Nights. And the goal is to get them to take off shark fin off the menu by disrupting their Friday night service. So that's every Friday, 6:30 to 8:30 at Fortune Garden Seafood Restaurant. And that's all I have for today. If you have any events you'd like us to share on the show, you can post them on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver, or just email us radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, and we would be happy to feature those events. I think I think that's all for the events I have today. So thanks, and I hope to see you out at them soon.
Every Friday night at 8 p.m., lay your burden down and get on board the gospel train. Music, interviews, live guests, local performance information. All aboard the gospel train, Fridays at 8 p.m.
Cherokee Louise is hiding in this tunnel in the Broadway bridge. We are crawling on our knees. We've got flashlights and batteries. We've got cold cuts from the fridge. Last year about this time, we used to climb up in the branches just to sway there in some breeze. Now the cops on the street, they want Cherokee Louise. People like to talk, tongues are wagging over fences, they're wagging over phones. All their doors are locked, God, she can't even come to our house, but I know where she'll go. To the place where you can stand and press your hands like it was bubble bath. Down under the street, my friend Cherokee Louise. Ever since we turned 13, it's like a minefield walking to the door. Going out, you get the third degree. And coming in, you get the Third World War. Tuesday after school, we put our pennies on the rails, and when the train rolled by,
we were jumping around. Hi, Sarah, can you hear me?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, great. So we're speaking to Sarah Brown, who's author of the blog Queer Vegan Food, and she's, like we said at the beginning of the show, she's writing a book regarding holistic nutrition for women who love women. So how are you doing today, Sarah?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on. So sorry that we couldn't get in touch with you earlier. It's a bit of complications here, but so I'd like to jump right in. So you run a blog called Queer Vegan Food. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. So as a plant-based only site, Queer Vegan Food includes only recipes that don't include animal products of any kind. And what we try to do is post truly queer recipes, so things like chocolate-covered kelp noodles, for instance, in an effort to expand the vegan culinary canon beyond traditional vegan cuisine, which tends to imitate the non-vegan world, vegan ice cream, hot dogs, fake meat, things of this nature. So while the site does feature some of those recipes, trying to really shed light on some of the queer, maybe less normative vegan recipes you'd likely not see in other blogs. And we also work to promote equality for people of all sexual orientations and believe that it can help people of all orientations benefit through a diet that doesn't promote cruelty towards animals.
Great. So can you tell us exactly what it is that, first of all, what do you mean when you say the word queer? And do you mean it as this kind of a term that is alongside, you know, gay, lesbian, or bisexual? Or, of course, do you mean it, you know, as something more inclusive? And what exactly makes these food queer food?
Sure. So queer to me is also about inclusiveness, as you said, going beyond normative definitions, whether that be sexuality and also veganism. I believe that, you know, it's great to have fake meat options and transitional foods to help people maybe eat plant-sourced versions of meat foods. But food can be a lot more than just imitation. You can have really unique things, and that's what I try to highlight on the blog and try to promote for people in terms of freedom and inclusiveness.
So, of course, within the queer movement, there's a fight for the ability and the right for people who are, like you said, non-normative to express themselves sexually in a way which feels right for them. So how do you see exactly that this struggle for kind of sexual expression and sexual freedom related to the struggle to animal liberation?
Right. Well, as humans, we have a voice, right, as individuals, whereas animals...
It seems that we lost Sarah. We'll try to get her back on the line. In the meantime, we'll play some music until we try to get her back on. Thanks.
He was sitting in the
Great. So we have Sarah back with us. Sorry about that. So as you were saying, you were linking exactly the struggle for sexual expression and freedom to the struggle for animal liberation. Seems that we may have lost Sarah once again. So what we're doing in the meantime, we're talking with the blogger of Queer Vegan Food, Sarah Brown. Hopefully she'll give us a call back. Again, maybe in the meantime, Alyssa, if you'd like, you can go ahead with the news while we get back with her.
I will do that. So first of all, there's a story that's been making headlines across BC. At least it's the Province newspaper, anyway, was one of the papers that reported this morning that a German Shepherd found Wednesday in a Kitsilano dumpster has died from his injuries. According to SPCA spokesperson Laurie Chordick, the dog went into cardiac arrest Thursday evening just before 6 p.m. and failed to respond even after 30 minutes of CPR. She said they did everything they could and that even if the dog survived, he could still be quadriplegic. And the investigation is now moving into a forensic phase as the SPCA gathers evidence on what caused the injuries. We definitely will get to the bottom of this. And if it is the case that these injuries were intentionally done, then we will pursue animal cruelty charges, Chordick said. The 2-year-old dog was discovered Wednesday, wrapped in bloody blankets, in a trash bin in the 1400 block of Maple Street in Kitsilano.
So if I can just pause you right there, I think we'll go right back to Sarah's interview.
Okay.
Thanks for that. We'll come back to the news in a moment. So we have Sarah back with us. Are you there, Sarah?
Hi, yes,
I am. Great. Okay, finally. So we're going back to this question, of course, the main question that I really wanted to focus on, what exactly the intersections are between queer sexuality and the queer movement and the struggle for animal liberation.
Exactly. Well, I believe that animal rights and human rights are inextricably linked. And within the queer movement, there is a fight to help people and animals express and live in a way that is their freedom, which is, I believe, natural born to live without being killed prematurely or being forced into normative societal roles. And just because a pig is a pig doesn't mean that it doesn't deserve what a dog or a cat would in our culture. And that's why I believe that freedom for animals is very much tied to freedom for us as sexual beings. All people can benefit from a compassionate lifestyle.
Great. So, of course, it's very hard to talk about these issues without talking about other forms of oppression, of course, like things such as patriarchy and sexism. And as myself, it seems to me quite obvious, you know, somebody who's a queer, cisgendered white man, it seems quite obvious to me that, you know, the struggle to be vegan, I notice more and more how much heteronormative forms of sexuality are so much tied up to meat eating. Essentially, that's very central to the idea of heterosexuality, this idea that men eat meat. So I was curious as to how does gender play into this role of work for you?
Wonderful. So a book that really influenced me early on was a book called The Sexual Politics of Meat by Carol J. Adams. And in that book, it's really great. I recommend it for all of your listeners out there to really understand the connections between gender and oppression against animals and looking at the ways in which women especially are oppressed as women, the way that animals are oppressed as seen as something that is consumed as meat, just like women. And I believe in respecting all bodies, and I would never want anyone to face harm due to their corporeal reality. So in the same way that perhaps a trans body or a queer body is worth less in the lens of some in society, the point is there are arbitrary distinctions, and as the queer vegan consciousness emerges, it's about promoting non-suffering and happiness for all creatures. So for myself, as a cisgendered woman, I believe that, you know, objectification can happen in all forms, and it's really important to put it out, and to put it out there as a vegan saying, I don't stand for oppression towards women, towards animals, and really connecting that feminist consciousness has been central to my work.
But I wonder if we can focus a bit more on that idea of the body, because it seems to me the idea of a body in terms of what a body can do, what it's able to do in terms of creating pleasure, sex, creation, performance, is something that's really central to queer thought. And a lot of queer writers and queer people, queer activists have talked about and focused on the body very much. So I wonder, how exactly do you connect your body, being that of a queer body, to the non-human body that you choose not to consume, wear, or use?
Yeah, so a common misconception in veganism is that it's just about what you eat or what you don't eat. But of course, veganism is about not choosing to use leather, not choosing to use wool, not choosing to exploit animals in terms of cosmetics, testing, products, not wearing fur, things like this. And for me, I really value the freedom I have to express my body and to live in a way that is in alignment with who I feel I really am. And I know that no animal that feels suffering would ever want to be exploited. And it's our role as people in power, as people, to not allow animals to suffer in the ways that we sometimes have as a community. And you're right, there is a sense of pleasure that we've really fought for as a queer community or as many communities. And I believe that animals, you know, they feel pleasure too. They feel pain. And one of the most important aspects to animal rights work is acknowledging how animals maybe aren't as intelligent as humans, but they feel, and focusing on feeling, I think is actually a really great work to, a really great way to unite all of these different efforts.
Great. So I wonder if we can actually touch on one other parallel that at least seems to me somewhat striking. It seems to me that one rarely, if ever, has to announce to their families or their loved ones that, you know, one is an anarchist or one is an anti-racist activist or a feminist. But we see there's a parallel notion in the sense of coming out as queer or as gay or as lesbian or as at least a sexual minority of some sort, and coming out as queer. You know, there's a constant kind of coming out to your friends, to your families at meals, and this can somehow become tiresome. Do you see similar parallels and in your own life and your own work, and exactly how has being vegan, coming out as vegan within the queer community related to you, and vice versa, how is coming out as queer related to you in the vegan community?
Great questions. I came out as a vegan and as non-normative sexual orientation at the same time, and I think that a lot has changed since I came out 7 years ago. I mean, there's a ton more vegan awareness becoming globally mainstream. Ellen DeGeneres, Kathy Freston, Bill Clinton, tennis star Venus Williams. I mean, these are really big names that are coming out as vegan. So I think that in the same way that queer rights are becoming more of a global issue, the President Obama in the United States' recent stance on gay marriage made pretty public different states growing more towards inclusiveness of marriage. I think it's becoming more visible and a lot easier to come out, and at the same time, it's still difficult for a lot of people, even within queer communities, to recognize the parallel oppressions. And I think that's part of my work in these circles and part of our growing activist circles. Vegan Ari, who has a company called The Scent of Scandal, the gay vegans, there's a bunch of groups. Our Hen House is a wonderful feminist vegan press and media outlet. And so all of these groups are working together, I think, to promote the intersectionality of oppression, these issues, and really making it okay and really known that within vegan circles, within LGBTQ circles, we have to have overlaps and we have to support each other and ultimately work together to accomplish our goals.
Great. So I actually want to talk about one other project that you're working on with Courtney Poole. And you, at least on your website, you write that it's a book about veganism and holistic health for women who love women. I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about this project.
Yes. So Courtney Poole and I are writing a book on plant-based nutrition. So Courtney is a nutrition coach, and she's trained in plant-based nutrition. So our book really addresses how LGBTQ women can get started on a healthy, vibrant lifestyle on all levels. Our book introduces how to follow proven strategies for incorporating a plant-strong diet, but we also tackle really difficult topics like emotional eating, body image, and the psycho-spiritual component to holistic health. Our populations are much more vulnerable to depression, alcoholism, smoking, things like that, and drug use. So for many women who love women, the challenges of coming out, being lesbian or bisexual, studies have shown that 35% of us have a history of drinking compared to only 5% of heterosexual women in different samples. So it's a pretty big issue that plant-based nutrition has been shown to help heal both within our communities and also, again, recognizing the parallels between oppression against women and oppression against animals can be beneficial for women of all sexual orientations.
Great. So actually, one of the last things I want to touch on, and you wrote something that was very interesting, and I want you if you can expand more on it. In a partner you wrote, in an article you wrote with Courtney Poole, you said that hiding our sexuality can mean hiding our romantic feelings, sexual identity, or relationships from those close to us. It can also mean refraining from acting on our sexual desires out of fear, or perhaps denying ourselves the acknowledgement that even we have desires for experiences with other members of the same gender. Patterns such as these can reveal themselves in our relationship with food. And I find this a very interesting thought. Can you expand more about this? Is this somewhat what your book is about, exactly this relationship between food and gender expression and sexual desire?
Yeah, that is a really big component, right? So in a relationship between two women, especially, body image and emotional eating issues are often amplified. If looking at the statistics within our communities, individual women are at a higher risk, and so lesbian women have that dual kind of statistic that we're dealing with. So basically the ways in which our bodies are expressed, whether we're hiding our desires for sexuality, hiding our desires, our appetites, or just really putting ourselves in these boxes that are based on societal images of what women should be, or even internalized homophobia, can be really challenging for many of us. So looking at a really holistic approach to healing things like binge eating disorder, eating disorders in general, but also just body image and overall fixation within a lesbian couple can really help people address what may arise. And through changing our diets and lifestyles can come into a place of compassion, both for ourselves and also extending that out to animals and to the entire planet. So through the environmental studies showing that veganism is really the way to go for environment, showing that veganism helps animals and helps our community really come to a place of compassion is really what we're trying to accomplish with this book.
Great. Thanks so much. And I really look forward to reading it. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great. And we look forward to your book coming out. So you're listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM CFRO Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada, and I will return back to the headlines with Alyssa. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. So just a couple more stories here. I'm happy to share that this morning, Winnipeg police announced, or the Winnipeg Press announced, that the police have expanded their Winnipeg Crime Stoppers tip line to help with animal cruelty cases. For the first time in Canada, citizens can call in tips about animal abuse or cruelty to an anonymous police-managed line. The tip line will accept calls relating to animal abuse, puppy mills, and dog fighting rings. Crime Stoppers has teamed up with a group called Paw Tipsters, a charity that works to combat animal abuse in the province. If a tip leads to an arrest, Paw Tipsters offers cash rewards. The group is currently soliciting donations to help pay the people to line to service host those tip lines. So yeah, that's exciting. And another one I have here is the Humane Society of the United States, as part of its ongoing campaign to help end the use of commercial gestation crates, which are a common farming practice that involves the extreme confinement of pregnant pigs for much of their life. They've announced plans to sue 51 industrial-style operations for unreported releases of ammonia. Ammonia is a potentially dangerous pollutant, and the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, requires facilities to report releases of it amounting to more than 100 pounds within a 24-hour period. HSUS says the 51 facilities located in top pork-producing states, Iowa, North Carolina, and Oklahoma, all release amounts that exceed this requirement. The organization explains more in their release. They said, "It was no surprise to find that many of those receiving notice were affiliated with the leaders and spokespersons of the National Pork Producers Council, a trade group that defends confining pigs in cramped gestation crates." Basically the HSUS used a mathematical formula on the EPA's website to determine which farms to sue, and they've admittedly they haven't carried out any on-site testing. In response, the Pork Producers Board says that the numbers aren't laws, but rather guidelines, and that some farms do have ammonia mitigation techniques in place. So I guess the HSUS is trying to get more more press around the gestation crates, and hopefully that helps in the eventual national banning of that practice. I think that's all I have for today, and on to you, Alon.
Great. Thanks, Alyssa. So we have with us on the line Krista Truman, who's a member of Fat Panic Vancouver. Fat Panic Vancouver is a collective of people, an alliance of people of different sizes committed to ending fat phobia and fat oppression, and committed to essentially presenting fat positivity as a viable alternative to what we have in our current society. And Krista has written numerous articles on fat positivity and also veganism. So hi, Krista.
Hello.
Great. Well, I'm super glad that you're with us. And I wonder if you can quickly explain to us what exactly is fat phobia, sizeism, and how is it related to sexism and body policing, essentially the work that Fat Panic Vancouver does?
Sure. Well, fat phobia is self-explanatory, I think, in that it just means a fear of fat. And that can be a fear of yourself becoming fat. It can be a fear of eating fat. It can be a fear of fat people. And when I say fear, I don't mean like you're cowering in the corner or cringing when a fat person walks into a room, but you have an internal dialogue going on in your mind where you compare yourself to them or think hateful things about them without really knowing them as a person. It's more like you're objectifying them. And sizeism, of course, is the effect of fat phobia. It's essentially the oppression of fat people in our society. And it is a cultural product of the fat phobia, and they kind of feed on each other. So when you ask how it relates to sexism and body policing, you can kind of imagine that sexism and body policing are the umbrella that fat phobia and sizeism hang out under, along with all sorts of other things like homophobia and body policing affects everybody, all women, all genders, but the fat phobia and fat oppression happen to a specific subset of people in our society. So it's kind of like all integrated, but I think it's really important that when we talk about fat oppression, we don't get caught up in a discussion about how all women struggle with body image, because that's true, but there is a special type of oppression saved just for fat people, and that's really what our focus is at Fat Panic, although we do understand that these things intersect.
And of course, this type of oppression is something very real and something that people do internalize. It's their internalization of a hatred of their bodies, such that they often commit very real violence onto their bodies, whether through intensive dieting or surgery. Can you tell us a bit about, the very real psychological and physical damage that fat shaming produces on people? But like you said, most notably, it is a gender form of oppression that affects women more particularly, more specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's, I think if you spoke to any woman in our society, you'd be hard-pressed to find one that didn't at some point or another struggle with her body image, especially with how much it weighs or doesn't weigh, because the flip side of the coin is if you're too thin, you also face a certain type of discrimination in our society too. I don't know. I think that the most damaging thing for fat people, a really concrete example of it is when we go to seek out health care, a lot of times your healthcare provider will have internalized their own negative feelings about fatness. And instead of treating you and your symptoms, they want to talk to you about how you need to lose weight and how all your symptoms will go away if you lose weight, and everything all comes back to what you weigh. And the unfortunate side effect of this is that fat people don't go to the doctor as often as thin people do, because they understand and realize from past experience that they're going to be treated to this type of stigma. And that, of course, has very real consequences in that there may be diseases that could be detected early that aren't because of fear of fat phobia in the medical community. So that's just one example. I could go on and on. There are all sorts. You could do a Google search on this and find limitless examples of how we don't go for the jobs that we want. We don't engage in like physical activities that we would probably want to do because of the fear of public shaming. We don't eat in public. You know, it's just all sorts of, it affects every aspect of your life. So
can you tell us a bit about what it means to then eat healthy and have a healthy lifestyle and yet still be overweight? Is it that we need to make a distinction between things like health and weight or fitness? What exactly do you see as kind of the categories that doctors are confusing so much and what we need to be moving towards?
Okay, well, first I just want to say that I object to the term overweight. I object to the term obese.
Fair enough, I
find that those terms don't adequately describe the body that I live in. Overweight implies that there is some ideal weight for every person. And if you don't fit that narrow margin, you are either over or under. And, you know, there's as much variation in human body weight as there is in human body height, and we don't call tall people over height. So the word I prefer to use is fat, because it is a descriptor, and I know it's a loaded word, and a lot of people have a hard time hearing it, but it's one that I feel is politically important for us to use because it allows us to reclaim what our actual condition of our body is. And obesity is a problematic word, too, because there's a pathology associated with it, and fatness in and of itself is not a medical pathology. There are lots of things that are correlated with fatness, but there are lots of medical conditions correlated with thinness, too. So if we could avoid using the terms overweight and obesity, that would be awesome. And the thing about health, it's this is the topic that always comes up that kind of derails the conversation away from the political aspects of fat positivity, mostly because people want to use it as a way to make it seem like it's a choice to be fat and that it's a simple matter of, like, calories in and calories out and, you know, a way to sort of say if you just made different choices, your body would fit in better, and so because you're making bad choices, it's okay for us to discriminate against you. Also, health is multifaceted. It's not just our physical fitness. It is a combination of, you know, emotional, mental, and spiritual and social factors. So I can tell you from personal experience that when I was my absolute lightest adult weight, and I was still fat at that time, but I was lighter than I am now, I was extremely emotionally unhealthy, and so I wasn't feeding myself properly, and I was sort of in the grips of an eating disorder at that time. So you can look physically fit or physically healthy because you're not fat, but that doesn't mean that you're healthy. It just means that your body fits into the narrow definition of what health is supposed to look like in our society. And like I said earlier, a lot of healthcare practitioners, when they're treating fat bodies, they only see the fat body and they ignore everything else about the person. So, you know, if you have strep throat or something, they want to give you a lecture about going on a weight loss diet, and that's not particularly helpful.
Great.
And, you know, there's endless media hype about the dangers of obesity, so I understand why this is forefront in people's minds. But people on average are actually only about 11 pounds heavier than they were in the early 80s. And so you have to remember that the media feeds on fear, and that's what sells the news. So when they can trump up something or a statistic or, and, you know, politicians, the same kind of thing, the more that they increase fear in our population, the easier it is to control us. But there is actually a solid body of peer-reviewed scientific evidence that shows that not only is fatness not inherently unhealthy or thinness inherently healthy, but that dieting doesn't actually work, and 95 to 98% of people who engage in dieting and do weight cycling or yo-yo dieting, they think that that's actually more dangerous than just staying at a healthy or a higher weight.
Great. Well, I do appreciate you calling me out on my language. And I think, you know, speaking of language and the type of language that we need to better use, I wonder if we can talk more specifically about fat phobia within the community, within the vegan community. Of course, veganism, often in the way it's presented in dominant media narratives, is something as being that which will make you lose weight, will make you really healthy. And this is something even we on, you know, just the show that we did last week, it was about how veganism was really key to being really athletic, for instance. So I wonder if you can talk about, if you want to, talk about your own experiences, or at least the dominant discourses that you see in the vegan community regarding sizeism and fat phobia.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's important to remember that even though we are vegans and we like to think of ourselves as special, we are still a product of our culture, and our culture is extremely fat phobic. So that is, of course, going to carry over into, you know, the reasons why some people become vegan, and people's hopes for becoming vegan often include wanting to lose weight so that they have a more acceptable, culturally acceptable body. My personal experiences have been mixed. In the beginning, I didn't really interact much with the vegan community because I had a baby and I didn't really know there was much of a community. And when I realized that there were, you know, things like potlucks and stuff like that, I was really excited, and I started to show up at them, and I quickly realized that there were no other fat people in the room. I know that there are other fat vegans out there. I guess they just weren't showing up at these events. And I think part of the problem with that is there was a tendency, and I don't think it was malicious, but I do think there is this kind of, you know, assumption when I walk into a room that I'm either a new vegan, and I'm not, I've been vegan since 1998, or that I'm, you know, a junk food vegan, or I don't really know how to make good food choices, and so I'd get a lot of sort of condescending comments or people telling me what I'm doing wrong with what I'm eating. And these comments wouldn't be directed at thin people, even if they were eating the exact same thing I was. So I think there's this desire to kind of like, you know, people want me to fit in, and they don't understand that maybe I'm okay with the way that I am, and I don't want to necessarily fit in, and yeah. So I found that really off-putting, and I stopped going to a lot of the events around town, just because every time I showed up at one, there was, you know, it was either direct or indirect stigma attached to my attendance in the events, and that made it difficult, for sure.
And of course, the large part of the irony of this is that a lot of vegans understand what it means to have their food choices policed and to have other people constantly critique, give advice about this.
Exactly.
But what I want to point to is that it's not just a problem of a few bad apples within the vegan community. That's a couple of people that, you know, that do this to you. But rather, it's actually an institutionalized structural problem where you get or large organizations like PETA and even the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine that yeah. have advertising that perpetuate the stigma against fat phobia. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be an issue at the core of veganism. So why is it that you think that vegan advocacy perpetuates fat phobia instead of being an ally in the struggle for fat acceptance?
That's a big question. First of all, I think that it's important to note that PETA engages in all sorts of wildly offensive campaigns that are, you know, they don't just engage in sizeism. They're extremely sexist. We've seen some, you know, racist campaigns from them. We've seen anti-Semitic stuff. You know, they're just notoriously insensitive group, and they do it because it gets them attention. And so it's really hard to take anything they do seriously, but you're right, a lot of people do listen to them. And I have been very disappointed in how the PCRM has conducted themselves in the last year or so with some of their more fat-phobic campaigns, because they never used to do that. It seems like they're taking a note from the PETA playbook or something. Why do they do it? I think that it's easy. Again, it preys on people's fear about being fat or not wanting to be fat anymore. And I think it's a lot easier, they feel it's a lot easier to approach people on that kind of level of discourse, because having conversations about the actual issues behind veganism, which are, you know, animal rights and the ethics of treating sentient beings as objects, are really convoluted and maybe not necessarily easy conversations to have with people. So I think they go to the easy stuff, which is prey on people's fear of fatness and their bodies. And that's all I think it is. I think it's easy, it's punchy, it's something everybody's comfortable with because, you know, all sorts of other organizations and companies do the same kind of thing, again, because we live in a fat-phobic culture, so.
Krista, do you think some of the problem is with the word diet, like the vegan diet? Is like, should we stop using that phrase?
Yeah, I mean, to me, veganism was never really a diet, and not even just, you know, diet is, there's a weight loss diet, and then there's the term diet in that it's just the food that we choose to eat. So that can be, that can complicate things. But I think, you know, you got the people that come to veganism as a way of eating and not necessarily like a philosophy or an ethos. So, sure, that's problematic, and maybe that needs to be explored more. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if just changing one word is actually going to change. Because like I said, we're steeped in it, this fat-phobic culture, and changing one word or changing the way we phrase things, you know, it's got to be an overall shift in the way that we look at bodies and human beings.
So when it comes to veganism, can you give our listeners some better tactics of persuasion? Or in other words, what are the intersections between veganism and fat positivity? Because it seems to me that it's a movement that can, of course, be an allyship, and there seems to be some sort of overlaps between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of intersections between the working against oppression of animals and working against oppression in all aspects of our world. So not only is the, you know, general sort of mainstream vegan community sizist, they also tend to be classist. You know, like, I see it in my community when I go to vegan events now. It's primarily white. It's primarily middle class. So there's a lot of avenues that we can go down to try to make it more intersectional and more accessible for people from all walks of life, and that really is ultimately what we want to do as vegans, right, is to make veganism accessible and a realistic option for everybody. And that comes from empathy, which I think is, you know, generally the motivating force for most of us. And so I think that we really need to get people to tap into that feeling of empathy, that feeling of connectedness, so that we can stop sort of perpetuating violence upon everyone who doesn't fit our idea of what an ideal vegan is.
Great. So, of course, if people want to learn more about how to be fat positive and be accepting of people of different sizes, they can, of course, go to Fat Panic Vancouver and read their resources there. Are there any kind of resources that you may recommend for people to look into if they want to become more fat positive?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd strongly recommend that you join up on our Facebook page, the Fat Panic Facebook page. If you're not onto Facebook, we have a website that you can go to and an email list you can join. We also have meetings. We've been kind of quiet the last few months, but we're planning another meeting coming up in September, and everybody is welcome at those, and we're going to do some anti-oppression workshops at those. Generally, I would just like people to take some time out of their day to Google the term health at every size. Maybe look into some ableist resources. And I really can't recommend strongly enough the work of Dr. Linda Bacon, who is probably one of the most outspoken proponents of the health at every size movement. And I don't know, there's just endless resources out there. All you've got to do is type fat acceptance into your browser, and you will come up with days and days of reading.
Great. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us, Krista.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
I'm so glad we covered the topic today. Thanks to our producer, Elon, for delving into those intersectional issues and expanding our understanding of some of the ways that speciesism and animal oppression relate to other kinds of oppression and discrimination. You are listening to 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada. And this is, of course, the Animal Voices show. We air once a week on Fridays at noon. Animal Voices Vancouver is where you'll find us on Facebook, Animal Voices YVR on Twitter. If you want to get in touch, give some feedback or suggestions, it's radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. On next week's show, we'll be talking to the organizer of the second annual Veg Fest Vancouver, and I'm crossing my fingers that we'll also have an interview with the maker of Maximum Tolerated Dose, a new documentary about animal testing. We'll leave you today with a song from one of Canada's most prolific songwriters, Ms. Joni Mitchell, and we want to tell you to please stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thanks for listening.
He was sitting in the lounge of the Empire Hotel. He was drinking.